Hello, this is Storkey. I'm your host, April. This is a podcast about history. I'm going to be discussing events, people, and sometimes just random things from history that interest me and are important. I am absolutely not a historian. I'm just a dork who spends a lot of time watching, reading, listening to anything I can get my hands on about history. And I want to talk about it. I think a lot can be learned from looking into the past, and I'd like to share what I've learned, and my opinion about what I've learned. And I hope you enjoy it. This week, I'm going to talk about Aaron Burr and what happened to him after his famous duel with Alexander Hamilton. So let's get all the basic biographical stuff about Aaron Burr out of the way first. Aaron Burr was born in 1756 and was the third Vice President of the United States. His family was from New Jersey and were very prominent. You know that famous sermon, "Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God"? Well, Aaron Burr's grandfather was the man who wrote that. Burr was orphaned at 2 and went to live with an uncle. He first studied theology in college, but then grew disenchanted with that and switched to law. He put his law studies on hold for a while to fight in the American Revolution, where he served under Benedict Arnold and then George Washington. Somehow, with all that going on, he managed to finish his law degree. He was, along with Alexander Hamilton of all people, even part of the defense team for the first murder trial once the U.S. became its own country. That whole story is super interesting and may actually be its own episode eventually. His wife Theodosia died in 1794. Their daughter, also named Theodosia, passed away in a shipwreck in 1813. Burr was involved in politics, serving in the New York State Assembly. He was New York State Attorney General. Then he was a senator. He unsuccessfully ran for president in 1796, coming in behind John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Pinckney. He ran for president again in 1800 in what was probably the wildest election the U.S. had had by that point. John Adams was running for his second term, but he came in third behind Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. The way elections went back then, getting the second most votes made Aaron Burr the vice president. It was while he was vice president that Aaron Burr got into that famous duel with Alexander Hamilton and killed him. When Burr is talked about, this is usually where his story ends. What happened after Burr shot Hamilton isn't really talked about much, but it's a lot, and it's bananas. Burr went back to New York after the duel, expecting to be thought of as a hero. Instead, he was shocked to find that he was shunned by almost everyone, and charged with murder and dueling. Dueling, the act of settling a dispute between two men by actually formally shooting pistols at each other in a highly ritualistic, choreographed way, had been a practice for hundreds of years by then, but had mostly fallen out of favor by this time. It was, however, still kind of a thing for aristocratic men at that time. It was seen as a matter of honor by gentlemen. My understanding is that by this time, most duels that were is scheduled the word, ended without anyone actually firing their gun. By this time, it was more about being gentlemanly enough and having enough honor to actually show up to the duel than actually going through with it, if that makes sense. But duels were illegal. Yes, fellow Hamilton fans, even in New Jersey, I actually checked. The penalty for dueling was just less harsh in New Jersey than New York, which is why they chose to go there. Since the duel did actually happen in New Jersey, though, he was found guilty in that state as well. In a letter to his daughter, Theodosia, Burr wrote, "There is a contention of a singular nature between the two states of New York and New Jersey. The subject in dispute is which shall have the honor of hanging the vice president." Burr left New York and went to South Carolina, where his daughter was living for a while, and then went to Georgia to hide out at a friend's house. But, as Burr was still the vice president, He had to go back to Washington, D.C. to do some vice presidenting. He actually had to go back to D.C. to oversee the impeachment trial of a Supreme Court justice. This is the only time a Supreme Court justice has been impeached in all U.S. history. That Supreme Court justice's name was Samuel Chase. He was impeached by the House, but was acquitted in the Senate. While there, in D.C., Burr managed to use his political connections to get all the charges in New Jersey against him from the duel with Hamilton dropped. Believe it or not, here's where things get wild. So, while president, Thomas Jefferson bought some land from France to expand the U.S. It's known as the Louisiana Purchase, and it was a lot of land. It basically doubled the size of the United States. Burr leased some land in Texas, which was still part of Mexico at that time. He used that land in Texas as a base from where he planned to attack Mexico, which was still Spain's territory at the time. The goal of this? To start his own country. I mean, to be fair, it's debated by historians if Burr was trying to expand the U.S. or start his own country, but in my very unprofessional, non-historian opinion, it seems pretty obvious to me that he was totally, absolutely trying to start his own country. I mean, he even had secret talks with the British ambassador to see if England would help him separate the land gotten in the Louisiana Purchase from the U.S. So, yeah. A man named James Wilkinson, who was described in one thing I read as, and I quote, arrogant, unscrupulous, and overly fond of liquor. He was one of Burr's top co-conspirators in all of this. Burr even persuaded Thomas Jefferson to appoint Wilkinson as the first governor of the Louisiana Territory, which I'm not sure if that's a coincidence or a conspiracy. Burr even spent time doing some training with a militia he had set up, then sent Wilkinson a coded letter letting him know he was ready to go. Wilkinson got this letter, which is known today as the cipher letter, and promptly decided this was all too much for him. Wilkinson wrote a letter to Jefferson informing him of everything that was going on. Jefferson responded to this by sending federal agents after Burr. Burr was eventually caught and arrested in what is now Alabama. He was then taken under guard to Virginia to stand trial, where he was accused of high misdemeanor for planning to attack the dominions of the King of Spain and treason for trying to seize New Orleans and convert American territory into an empire of his own. This trial lasted for months. I mean, Burr's term as vice president had been over for a few years by then, but still, Burr had been a vice president. He was eventually acquitted on a technicality. His lawyers argued that to be guilty of treason for levying war under the Constitution, the accused must have committed an overt act in a war, testified to by two witnesses, and committed in the district of the trial. Also, to be fair, the only real physical evidence they had against Burr was that coded letter Wilkinson had gotten. But the letter Wilkinson handed over to the prosecution was written in his own hand. He claimed he had lost the original. Burr may have won this trial in legal court, but the court of public opinion found him very guilty. So guilty, in fact, that people were literally burning him in effigy, and Burr had to leave the U.S. He went to Europe, where, up to his old tricks, he then tried to get the British and French governments to start a new nation in the American Southwest. He did eventually come back to the United States, though. He returned in 1812, probably because England and the U.S. were at war then. There's a line in Wikipedia that cracks me up. He was ordered out of England, and Emperor Napoleon of France refused to see him. I mean, I think this is a pretty good indicator of Burr's poor social status at this time. Even Napoleon didn't want anything to do with him. But when he did go back to the United States, people had somehow mostly forgotten his attempt to take the Louisiana Purchase for himself. I mean, nobody liked him or wanted much to do with him after this, but they just kind of let the whole treason thing slide, which is wild to me. Toward the end of his life, Burr went back to New York, where, despite the 1804 ruling against him for killing Alexander Hamilton, he was never actually tried for murder. I don't understand that either, and I haven't been able to find a good reason that people just let something like murder go like that. He revived his law practice in New York. Kind of. I mean, it was there, but not very successful. And he married his second wife, Eliza Jamel, in 1833. Eliza was super wealthy. She was the widow of a French wine merchant, and after his death, she became the wealthiest woman in America. This was a short and disastrous marriage, where Burr spent a lot of Jamel's money on land speculation. Their marriage only lasted 4 months. Jamel, in what I consider to be a particularly savage move, even hired Alexander Hamilton Jr., Hamilton's second oldest son, to be her lawyer for her divorce with Burr. I can't even imagine how awkward that whole trial must have been for everyone involved. Exactly how awkward it was, we'll never know for sure, as records only show, and I quote, as it would be just in the period of the divorce trial, during which they were hurling correspondence at each other, and, on the part of Burr, in unfair proportions of 4-1. This divorce took, like, 3 years, which I'm assuming all the correspondence between Burr and Jamel is at least partially responsible for. Over those years, Burr suffered several strokes. A judge finalized Burr and Jamel's divorce a few years later on September 14, 1836. Burr died that same day at the age of 80. I read somewhere once, and I'm paraphrasing here, that Aaron Burr never really fit in with the men who are considered America's founding fathers. He wasn't even really very respected by them, and that this is because his basic outlook on everything was so different from theirs. Aaron Burr was too self-interested to be a real part of the group of men who seemed to want to work together to create a system that was more about the betterment of the society as a whole than just themselves. So he was always kind of outside that circle, looking in. The person who said that definitely put it much more articulately than I ever could. But there you go. I think if you look at Burr's actions over his life, this seems a pretty accurate take. I mean, I don't think he was all bad. I'd like to believe no one is. But, yeah, pretty much mostly. John Quincy Adams, son of John Adams, and 6th President of the United States, wrote in his diary when Burr died, Burr's life, take it all together, was such as in any country of sound morals, his friends would be desirous of burying in quiet oblivion. Agreed. I'm going to end this by giving myself credit for greatly restraining myself and making it through this entire episode by only making one single Hamilton the Musical reference the entire time. Sources I used for this were Mental Floss, History Today, American Heritage, SupremeCourt.gov, PBS, and of course, as always, the wonderful Wikipedia. So that's it. That's the episode. Thank you so much for listening. You can reach me at dorkypod@gmail.com. Let me know what you think of the podcast. Let me know if I left something out or got something wrong. Or let me know if there's something in particular in history you'd like me to talk about. There's also a Facebook group called Dorky Podcast. Join it and be part of our community. Also, please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're hearing it. It helps the podcast grow. But more importantly, your feedback will help me make this a better podcast. Until we meet again, friends.